Splendid.
Okay, welcome. So today my talk is about some work I've been doing over the last few years. It's part of a wider program of research which has involved field work in Australia, Canada, the US and the UK. The wider program is called Transatlantic Travels, which is also the title of the book that I'm trying to write. And it's about routes in the sense of policy and place, and it's about territorial relationships, and about routes in terms of pathways, movements, trajectory. And as Johnny reminded us yesterday, quoting Magnuson, the politics of urbanism is a politics of movement. The aims of the programme of research are fivefold, to consider, I guess, how we theorise the urban as comprising locations of proximity and distance, to explore the ways in which policy is made in an urban world of interconnections and disconnections, to examine the challenges cities are facing regarding the finance of infrastructures. I'm interested about infrastructure, how it's financed, and the emergence of different models of indebtedness and speculation. And then, I guess, finally, to unhide or trouble the financial decisions which underpin the production of built environment. And I'll tell you a little story about how I got interested in this, and part of it is actually how issues around finance and decisions around finance often get hidden when you walk around the city. It's not obvious, for example, how the finances behind a particular building were put together and what the consequences were for the local people, or anyone actually, about how the financial system works. Just let me talk about methods, given we're part of the brief for the programme today, we're talking about methodological innovation. I'm not sure any of my methods are innovative, but I'll tell you a bit about them anyway. So over the last couple of years, 100 or so semi-structured interviews in Chicago, Edinburgh, various sites in California, various sites around the US, various interviews at Scottish and UK level, and various places in Australia and Canada, archival work in Chicago, Edinburgh and Sacramento, California, participant observation on walking tours in Chicago and Sacramento, and then participant observation at conferences and seminars in London, Manchester and Sacramento. And again, I can talk a bit more about that. Today, though, I'm just going to talk about one particular example, and that's of Edinburgh in Scotland. But again, in doing so, I'll make reference to a small number of elsewheres, the experiences of which have been drawn upon in the city. And at the end, I'll come back to some of the wider, I think, theoretical and methodological issues or challenges that I guess some of us picked up on yesterday, and maybe that will run through today, and certainly ran through my thinking and Tim's thinking when we put together the details for this workshop. Okay. So a couple of maps. Edinburgh's just there. And there's, I'm going to come back to that, that's the waterfront. So Edinburgh's the capital of Scotland, population just under 500,000, and an economy that relies for the most part on the finance sector and heritage and tourism sectors. Apart from when I'm in Edinburgh, I always ask the question, who's been to Edinburgh? So hands up if you've been to Edinburgh. Okay, yeah, that's impressive. So Edinburgh, clearly a tourist destination, so attracts people from all around the world for a range of different reasons. I'll come back to talk about that in a minute. The area I'm interested in is just here, just there. It's a place called Leith, which is on the south shore of the Firth of Forth. It's regarded as Edinburgh's port and has been part of the city of Edinburgh since 1920. And listen to this. When in a referendum, the people of Leith voted 6-1 against becoming part of the city. So 26,000 people, 810, voted against becoming part of Edinburgh. 4,340 voted for the merger, but the annexation still occurred. So there's democracy, liberal democracy in action. And that relationship between the two, the Leith, the port, doing the dirty work of begrudgingly becoming part of the city, and Edinburgh, doing the artistic, salubral work, is an antagonistic one that characterises local politics to this day. And the green line around there is the area that's traditionally known as the Leith waterfront. Within the area, you can see just there, it's the Scottish Executive. That was part of the Scottish government that was moved out there in the 1990s to try and bring the area closer to the city. And also there, I'll come back to this, but the Royal Yacht Britannia, appropriate, we're talking about the Royals today, which is berthed on the front. The port itself was publicly owned, that is owned by the British government, and so it was part of the wider privatisation programme and became fourth ports in 1992. It's still a working dock, although the numbers employed have been reduced from thousands to tens. as the amount of the work done at the dock has shrunk. So it's a privatised port in decline, generating large-scale unemployment and knock-on consequences for the local communities, who feel disengaged from the cultural, economic and political centre of the city, despite only being 2 miles away from it. So I asked a number of you who've been to Edinburgh, did any of you go out to Leith? Okay, so there's 4 of you been out there. Okay, so it's only a couple of miles, it's 20 minutes in a bus, you can walk there in half an hour. Most people who visit Edinburgh don't even know that Edinburgh, in quotes, has a waterfront, and certainly would think not about going out there. So over the last 3 decades, there have been various attempts to redevelop areas of the waterfront. So this is a piece from the local art, 1972, How to Bring Life Back to Leith. So it's part of a two-parter in the local newspaper about the port, the problems it was facing, how it might go about addressing them. This is an article from the 1980s. Port turns over a new leaf, obviously a play on word from the word leaf. Local press is replete with these kinds of cheesy play on words, which I rather enjoyed when I was sitting in the library. 2 from the 1990s, Sunshines and La Costa del Forth. So, for those who don't know, cultural reference points to bits of Spain, and then waterfront developers promise a fourth Riviera. So again, what there has been over the last sort of, since the early 1970s, the 40 years, regular attempts to kickstart redevelopment, as the work that's done, the employment that's done on the port has slowly wound down, as local communities have been affected, and more the land has been left vacant. This is a map from the 2008 master plan. So the latest example, and actually it's a more serious example that I think than previous attempts, has been this 2008 master plan document. And this area that you can just see with the red around it is very similar, almost maps neatly onto the green lined area I showed in a previous map. That's a 144-acre site that was earmarked for redevelopment with a series of urban villages, apparently about 17,000 new homes, a waterfront plaza, a reinvigorated residential offer, and some changes to the dock entrance to allow in larger cruise liners. And I'll come and talk a bit about that, the cruise industry in a minute. The document itself, the master plan, is replete with references to the US as the origin of the waterfront model and to waterfront redevelopment strategies elsewhere in the world. So the Inner Harbour of Baltimore gets a lot of mention, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Portsmouth and Singapore gets mentioned in the document. And here the story is one of absence of alternatives in contrast to Rita's account yesterday. Although a local group of architects who I spoke to called JUMP, joined up master planning, organised against the plan, generating an alternative one, and the people who are interested, I can talk a bit more about that. But actually there was very little resistance to this master planning. This next PowerPoint gives you a sense of the ways in which the area is being reimagined through the redevelopment, so fairly standard fare, similar-ish in the nature of their images, the ones that Rita showed us yesterday. So this is, you know, an attempt to reimagine the front with the large cruise liner docked there, bringing in wealthy Americans who are then going to head into town and spend their pounds, of which they'll get a few more than they would have a couple of years ago. You know, and various places to park the liners. Bit of development going on there. You can see there's the kind of cafe culture. Anyone who's been out to Leith knows it's very windy and often very wet. So these people who are sitting out are quite brave. And that's unlike that sun. That's not part of the master planning document. It lies beyond the scope of anyone I spoke to. And again, this one's interesting because it has people in, which isn't always the case, I find, these master planning documents. Often they're very, they have no actual bodies inside. Anyway. This is what it looks like at the moment. Some evidence of past and largely unsuccessful ways of residential development with half-empty condos surrounded by vacant tracts of land. The new housing stock that was built during the mid-2000s does not meet the needs of local residents. It is for families and not for couples. There is a long list of people waiting for public housing in this part of the city. Hence, a number of these condos remain semi-occupied, and there's little social reproductive infrastructure around it. So no doctors, roads, shops, etc. Sorts of things you would need to support a growing population. And actually, a number of the properties are being bought up by a housing association. But of course, actually buying a housing association, buying properties in this area, given it's a brownfield with lots of cleanup costs, it's actually much more expensive than doing housing public housing in the suburbs. So there's a real issue there about trying to do affordable housing in this part of town. My interest started off in the local politics, in quotes, around the waterfront redevelopment, the ways in which different public, private and community agendas are being brought forward or not, and what this meant for the master planning process and its subsequent discussion at public forums. I can say a little bit more if people want to know. Underpinning these differences was a clear disjuncture between the aspirations of local communities for a clean, safe and welcoming place where they could afford to live and where there was good quality employment, and the aspirations of policymakers and practitioners who wanted to create various sites that could capture value from incoming tourists on the way between the large cruise ships and the centre of Edinburgh. So where the cruise ships do park, they tend to get onto buses and go straight into the centre of Edinburgh and spend their money, and what they want to do is find a way of keeping them close by and spending some of their money through the retail offer, maybe staying in the hotels. However, I became increasingly interested in how the project was to be financed, in part because poor people were telling me in my interviews, but also because of how the recession in the UK, so we're talking here about 2010-2011, was changing the apparent viability of the master plan. So having done all this labour to get the master plan produced and done lots of consultation, and just when it looked like something might actually happen, of course, the recession hit, which meant that suddenly the financing of this whole big scheme became less viable. In particular, I became interested in the assembling, production and circulation of this document and its place in wider relations of decision-making in Edinburgh, Scotland and within the UK. This was the business case made by Edinburgh City Council for the creation of the first tax increment financing area in the UK. There were a number of iterations as it went back and forth between different institutions. So it was moving between the Scottish Government, Scottish Futures, that's an organisation that basically oversees for Scotland the financing of infrastructure, and Edinburgh City Council. So three organisations backing this document back and forth. Issues of accountability, of anticipation, of risk, particularly of risk, characterised the discussions, i.e. who was going to carry the risk if the waterfront redevelopment plan didn't go ahead, and if it went ahead and didn't deliver what it was supposed to deliver, who would carry the risk, financially but also politically. The document made the case for Edinburgh City Council being allowed to borrow 84 million or 162 million Singaporean dollars. The plan was, could they borrow this money up front? The money would be spent on four bits of infrastructure that would be used to create the conditions, they hoped, for private sector investment on the Leith waterfront. So the argument was that the private sector would not do the sorts of things that was needed to be done because the risks were too great. So that if the public sector borrowed this money and spent it, it would create the conditions where private sector would come in and do what it does best, apparently. So four bits of infrastructure. One was the construction of a public esplanade and outside the Ocean Terminal shopping centre, i.e. a place where you could go and look at the boat, which was apparently the boat, the Royal Yacht, is Edinburgh's second biggest tourist attraction. So the idea is to kind of get people to hang around there and look at the boats. They were also going to introduce a new road, which would link up different bits, but also would allow people to get to what developments were already taking place. A finger pier next to the Royal Yacht Britannia to give visitors a better initial sight of it and to allow cruise liners to stop. And Edinburgh is very clear, it's looking to capture more of the share of the growth in the global market in cruise lining, which is currently valued at 45 billion Singaporean dollars. There are 20 million people who get cruises of one sort or another around the world. It's a big growth industry. Edinburgh wants to capture more of this value by putting more people in and getting them to spend more of their money. The fourth and final element, and this is the one which is the biggest controversy, if there was any, locally, was about new lock gates. These were the entrance to Leith docks to facilitate both cross and forth ferry traffic and to allow larger boats. The problem at the moment is the big large cruisers can't get in, and if they do get in, it takes them an awful long time to get in and out. So the idea is you put new docks, you encourage larger boats. The document reports that in making this expenditure, there is, and I quote, the potential to unlock, and the talk of unlocking occurs a lot in the stuff I'm going to talk about today, 660 million or 1.2 billion Singaporean dollars of private investment, generating almost 5,000 jobs. So that was the promise, the carrot. Others in Scotland subsequently set about putting together their first business case in a race to become the first UK TIFF, Aberdeen, Glasgow, whole range of places, and south of the border in England, there are a number of local authorities such as Manchester exploring the possibility of creating a tax income and finance industry. That document makes reference directly to Chicago and to the US more generally, evidencing the success as part of the case it makes. Those I spoke to reinforce this. Some I spoke to had visited the US, particularly California, which is the first state to introduce TIFF in the early 50s, and they'd spoken to people on the ground. Others had read about the Chicago experience in a range of UK document-sponsored reports of the late 1990s. Others still had read one or more of the various consultancy and think tank documents produced in the UK on TIFF and other models for financing redevelopment. There was a range of ways in which a number of other places elsewhere figured in the local discussions and negotiations over the financing of the master plan. It's early for this sort of diagram. Actually, let's skip it. So basically, this diagram in itself is worthy of a paper. Not least, it's hard to explain. But the more interesting account is not the diagram. This is one that comes straight from from this. But the more interesting thing is that actually this diagram or version of figures occurs everywhere around tax increment and financing. The diagram does some work in terms of representing a particular version of the future that is made more likely if you buy into the thinking underpinning this document. A more interesting one actually is to think about this. So essentially what TIFF does is it takes the base rate of an area. So say you've got a chunk of land with a lot of properties on, and at the moment the total amount you bring, total amount you can generate from that in terms of business rates is $1,000 Singaporean. But you believe if you borrowed some money and spent that money in a certain kind of way, the business rates would go up. Okay, so say $5,000 Singaporean. What you do is you freeze the initial rate at 1,000. Okay, you spend the money. The next year, $1,000 goes where it normally goes, to wherever the tax district. The extra money, however much that is, goes to a separate account. And that account is used to pay off the debt if you borrowed it in bonds or borrowed it from another bit of public sector. So in this case, CEC stands for City of Edinburgh Council. So it finances the delivery of development. So it pays for the master plan. Okay, it delivers growth, we hope. New hotels, new tourists, new retail expenditure. The TIFF mechanism captures the uplift, the extra money that's generated in business rates, because everywhere is worth more because it's making more money. The captured revenues and income are used to meet debt repayments. And the debt can last for even, in the US, it tends to be around 23, 24 years. After that, the money goes back to the normal taxing districts, which in the UK would be the central government by and large. Is that kind of clear? Okay, splendid. It wasn't always clear to me when people tried to explain. But in my interviews, I would ask people to explain what the interesting thing was, the different ways in which people actually use different kinds of language to explain the same image. So in this case, in Edinburgh, what they were arguing to do, Edinburgh City Council would keep 71% of the extra income. So this model relies on the fact that the local authority can keep the uplift. If it can't keep the uplift, why would it borrow the money? Okay, that's the issue in the UK. In Scotland, they're allowed to keep all the business rates, so they've had a negotiation. 29% goes to the Scottish Government, 71% stays with Edinburgh City Council. So it's worth it taking a risk, borrowing the money, so it generates more revenue. Okay. In seeking to understand the roots reference in Edinburgh and at the Scottish level, reference is made to a number of documents. These are just some examples. All mention gaps of various sorts. So these are a range of consultancies, think tanks, that have made an argument for rethinking how in the UK you finance. Please end. Surely that's the wrong one. I shall whiz through them. So these are a range of documents that were produced that kind of generated some interest in tax increment financing and actually more generally revisiting how you finance infrastructure and economic development. There was also a series of conferences and seminars that involved speakers from the US and from the UK. I went to a number of these. I guess I won't say much more, just to note that I think these sorts of events are important as sites of circulation, comparison, and translation, of legitimization and reinforcement, of educating and learning. In economic geography, there was a kind of literature around conferences and seminars. Urban geography, less so, but there is that kind of emerging sense that these are important sites that are worth doing work at. There's a quote which I won't show. This is someone basically saying that, as I spoke to those in Edinburgh and to those in the UK policy community, the flurry of activities in the late 2000s, in constituted by the production of these documents and the organising events, did not mark the first time TIFF had been discussed in the UK.
I think we've got the timing wrong, Kevin. Keep going.
Yeah.
Okay. When these think tanks and consultants were producing their documents, they're also aware of the inclusion of tax increment financing as one of the recommendations made by this report. So in 1999, the UK government commissioned a task force to basically revisit the future of British cities, particularly around brownfield regeneration. The report was called Towards an Urban Renaissance. Incredibly influential. First time anyone had done this in Britain for 30 years. And there were subsequent follow-ups, paying for an urban renaissance and towards a straw urban renaissance. I've spoken to a number of people involved in their production to try and understand how they came about, the organisational architects that underpin their production, and the nature of the visits to the various locations. Towards an Urban Renaissance was the first published in 1999. This slide shows how in the Towards an Urban Renaissance report, they report on policy tourism. They visited Chicago and discovered TIFF. They did not know about it in advance, rather they encountered it on site, heard about its successes, were shown examples of the change in the built environment of the city that its use had made possible, and they returned home seeking to translate it into something that might work in the UK financial legal context. So this was not some attempt to go out and harvest a policy from elsewhere in the world. This was just opportunistic. They happened to go out there, they weren't sure what they were going to see, but they thought Chicago would be an interesting place because it had done some interesting things around brownfield. And when they got there, they would introduce this thing called tax increment financing. So here's a quote there, where they make an argument. And what they did was, the members of the task force, in this case it's a chap called Chris Brown, wrote postcards. So they used postcards as a way of conveying what they learned, as if they would write a postcard. Again, reinforce the notion of policy tourism. And in other words, you'd write a postcard to your parents or friends when you were somewhere warm and exotic. Okay, this is the last slide before I conclude. It shows the US and when TIFF statutes were introduced onto the books. The US, as Tim made the point yesterday, should not be generalised from, neither should we generalise about the US. In the case of TIFF, it's highly internally differentiated. Some states have had TIFF statutes but have never used them. Some have been very conservative. That has fed to the kind of conservative nature of some US states. One, Arizona, is still in the process of introducing a TIFF statute. Different states use TIFF in different kinds of ways. So what's going on is often in some of the people I spoke to in Edinburgh and UK in particular, when they're referencing, they're being very explicit about Chicago, often for a range of reasons that I don't have time to talk about today. Often talking about California because they knew that was the first place. But there's a more general reference to the US that kind of bundled all these differences together and rather essentialised the country. Okay. Few conclusions. Okay. So first conclusion is just that the politics over the Leith waterfront in Edinburgh remains local if we understand the term in an open, porous manner. The different aspirations and visions for the area are playing the business cases, interviews, press releases. So it's clear to me that people have different views about what Edinburgh should be about and the relationship between the centre of Edinburgh and Leith. And this came out in a number of different ways, both in terms of the way the waterfront was talked about and reported on in local newspapers, the interviews I did, and the way it was talked about and narrating the business cases. A number of different stakeholders of different geographical reach were present in the debates, discussions and planning. So it's a combination from below and above, particularly in terms of financing the conditions for the master plan. And then finally, I guess, the geographically distant but socially proximate actors and places present in the Edinburgh case, which meant that for me at least, it made sense to leave the city to find out more about what was going on in the city. And then finally, this last PowerPoint was written this morning, just after 6. Just some thoughts, things I've been grappling with, and apologies to Tim, because he's heard me grappling with them before. So first of all, about theorising the urban, and Tim and I, in the kind of spiel that went round in the workshop, thinking about geographically extended, relational, and territorial, locally grounded geographies. So how to be attentive to both aspects that are often inseparable and deeply entwined. Are we struggling to put them apart, or should we just acknowledge that they're mutually constituted? Secondly, issues around methodological innovation. Locating the field. So geographically distant sites, co-located and rendered proximate through the making of policy, which involves going beyond the city limits and exploring circulations and comparisons. So geography has a sense about where the field is. It's not quite as pronounced as anthropology, whether Field would be a village or a city or a town. But is it possible, as some anthropologists talk about doing a kind of anthropology of policy, which actually means about geographically disparate places? Historising the current juncture. A range of methods required to make sense of how and where decisions are made, which to me is actually not that different to the challenge many of us face in our respective fields. Certainly many of the talks yesterday, for example, were not done in real time, as Yas quite neatly talked about it yesterday, as in when those interviewed were actually doing things or making decisions. But rather, many of the people who spoke yesterday were asking interviewees to recollect, to remember how decisions came out, how outcomes were achieved. So while there is an issue, I think, with this work about the fact that actually what you're attempting to do is go back over something that's happened already and make those connections, what you're actually doing is partly representing the connections that are already made by those people you're speaking to. And you face the same challenges you do when you speak to a lot of people about accounts that have already happened. The mutual constitution of failure, success, absence, presence, immobility. So seeking to move beyond some dualisms and acknowledge that mutual constitution, that one does not exist without the other. So for example, in the case of Edinburgh, the TIF has not yet been established because Forth Ports were taken over by another company who then sold the ocean terminal. Various stakeholders have got very nervous about the financing of the TIF, partly because what they want to do in Edinburgh now is renewable energy, and that will not generate the uplift that retail and tourism will do. So here perhaps is an absence presence, an example of failed mobility maybe. And finally, studying up, down and studying through. So the work of anthropologists Shaw and Wright I've used, who attempt to trace connections between different organisational and everyday worlds, even where actors in different sites do not know each other or share a moral universe. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thanks very much.